You should have the same handout, 2 pages that we gave you last Sunday. Is that what you have, 2 pages? Romans 1:21, accompanied by Hebrews 11:3 and Romans 1:22 on the next page. That's what you should have. You know the statement of the making of books. There is no end. But I don't find that something to decry. These are the ones I went through the last 2 days. Now, there's one really good one here. I liked it a lot. The Complete Idiot's Guide to Understanding Einstein. Dr. Chaim Weizmann, who was one of those influential in getting Britain to open the Holy Land to the return of the Jews, he once crossed the Atlantic on the same ship with Einstein, and every day they spent hours, according to his report, they spent hours with Einstein explaining his theory of relativity. Oh, it's so simple. So simple. You read it in the textbooks. E equals mass times C squared from the Latin word celeris, which means swiftness. That's why he picked C. Every day across the Atlantic, this brilliant mind of Dr. Chaim Weizmann was challenged as Einstein himself explained his theory of relativity to him every day. And when they finished the trip, Chaim Weizmann's on record saying, when we finished the trip, I was convinced that he understood his theory. Now, if Einstein couldn't do it to Chaim Weizmann, what chance have we got? But as we delve into this present state of scientific understanding of the universe, I don't want you to lose sight of why we're doing this. I'm not a physicist. I didn't get my PhD in science. I did get an undergraduate unit major in geology and an official minor in physical sciences, but that doesn't scratch the surface, and it was way back in the early 50s. And you're outdated as a physicist if all you know is what was written last week. It's changing that fast. In fact, Stephen Hawking is on record. Somewhere in one of these books. Here it is. In his brief history. Am I boring you already? In his brief history of time, he says, and he just updated that, by the way, with fancy pictures and added a few more things about wormholes and time travel. What would it mean, and I will come to this again at the close of the message, what would it mean if we actually did discover the ultimate theory of the universe? As was explained in chapter 1, we could never be quite sure that we had indeed found the correct theory, since theories can't be proved. But if the theory was mathematically consistent and always gave predictions that agreed with observations, we could be reasonably confident that it was the right one. But we have a problem, he goes on to say. In Newton's time, it was possible for an educated person to have a grasp of the whole of human knowledge, at least in outline. But since then, the pace of the development of science has made this impossible, because theories are always being changed to account for new observations. They're never properly digested or simplified so that ordinary people can understand them. You have to be a specialist, and even then you can only hope to have a proper grasp of a small proportion of the scientific theories. Further, the rate of progress is so rapid that what one learns at school or university is always a bit out of date. Only a few people can keep up with the rapidly advancing frontier of knowledge, and they have to devote their whole time to it and specialize in a small area. The rest of the population has little idea of the advances that are being made or the excitement they are generating. 70 years ago, if Eddington is to be believed, only 2 people understood the general theory of relativity. I doubt that. I think it's only 1. Nowadays, tens of thousands of university graduates do, and many millions of people are at least familiar with the idea. That's how complicated and fast it is. My PhD, as you know, to Stanford in philosophies of education. Minors in geography and unit minors in comparative religion. Another minor in educational psychology. So, I'm not in my field. The purpose of digging through all this and pulling out of my library, because I have kept up on the new books, knowing that it's a dated, fast-marching area, is done for just one reason. Romans 1:21 declares that God's mad. He's had a slow burn, building up. Orgy is the word in the Greek. Apokalyptitai, away from, being buried, hidden, veiled, covered. His slow burning wrath is being revealed. And he stated why. He has said that the universe, the creation, contains, this is a declaration, not an argument. This is what Paul declares, that the universe contains fingerprints, footprints, evidences of his, at the very least, supreme being and power. That the universe calls out for an explanation that God says there's enough traces I left, footprints, fingerprints, handprints, and evidences, that you ought, with no other knowledge, to come to a conclusion. I exist. And I'm a supreme power to have done it, organized it, arranged it, and still control it. And if you didn't see that, you can't just sit back and say, I don't see it. Because what is implied in the basic words of these texts is that the capacity to see, and I could go afield in this message to what is one of the most ancient doctrines of the church, prevenient grace, that the initiative starts with God, and no man can come to the Father, as Jesus says, unless the Spirit draw him, and that there is something in us, the receiver that must receive the transmission, that is there for everyone to see. General revelation, apart from any special light, any oracle people, any knowledge of Jesus, There is a faculty. You see it best in children. To stand in awe and wonder and have faith easily, which is why Jesus says, you've got to become as a little child. And God is saying, not only am I mad because you haven't recognized least of all this minimum awareness of my presence and my power, and have not stood before this handiwork and seen my worth, giving me glory, and thanked, I mean in the vastness of the universe, the anthropic principle as they call it, that this earth is as it is because we are as we are, to oversimplify it, that out of all the multiplied millions of galaxies, this one fits. That you can have the life you have on this little speck in the universe and not be thankful, not stand in awe at God's presence, not recognize at least His supreme being, not want to know the who instead of just the what. He's mad. And the consequences of His anger is because you have not recognized Him, He will withdraw, take from you a capacity that all men have, and leave you without that capacity, because instead of glorifying Him and thanking Him, you become self-deceiving, is the word, translated became vain, in the reasoning, the dialogues, the thought processes of your mind are darkened in your heart, and it calls the senseless heart, and the word thanatos speaks of an understanding with the awe in front of it that is removed. A faculty, a gift from God to all mankind, because your reaction to the creation lacks God in the equation. Now, I'm more tolerant when I started this than God is. He's changing my mind. I'm angry, and was always angry through university, at the attitude that you're somehow less than acceptable to include God in the equation. God's not to be a part. Whatever the answer is, God's not part of the equation. And I sought for a lesser level when I used to sit in discussions with fellow graduate students. At least make room for this as a respected option. I'll respect your view. Why do I have to suddenly lose intellectual stature? Because I have God in my equation. That was where I was going. God's meaner than me. God's not that tolerant. Quid pro quo. They've ruled him out, so he's ruling you out. You rule God out of the equation, he takes from you the capacity to find God in the equation. That's why I'm doing this. I don't want you to lose sight of that. That apart from God, we're moving into a catalog of sins that I've listened to preachers revel in. They get vicarious enjoyment in preaching against these sins. And how many times did you read this list of sins that any 12-year-old in today's world knows more about than most fundamentalist preachers I ever listened to? I mean, all you have to go is into a bathroom and a playground, there's more on the wall describing these sins than the average preacher ever thought of. I have one in mind that I'm thinking of. He used to get up and He'd go through this with a dictionary, and we teenagers there would want to jump him and say, no, that's not, even in those days, that's not what it means. That's not the way you do it. If I could have taken him to my ice truck, he could have preached better. Of course, I drove. What I want you to understand is those sins are not the cause of God's wrath. Those sins are the result of God's wrath. Because God turns you over. And without His help and with the removal of the faculty of response to God from your very nature, this is what you become. So don't think that God suddenly is looking down, oh, naughty, naughty, look what they're doing from Romans 1:23 or 4 to Romans 1:32. I never saw such horrible things. I want to get mad at them. No, I'm madder than hell at them, so push and look at them go. The sins are the result of a prior condition of non-God awareness and non-respect for God and ruling God out and putting yourself in the middle. We're right back to the Garden of Eden. They weren't satisfied to have it all except the one thing that named God's sovereignty. They wanted the garden all to themselves. Out goes God. The only difference is God threw them out. And it predated the garden. Lucifer, crowning cherub on the mountain of God, the Bible says his pipes and tabrets were created in him. The devil's a created person, a creature. Created with his musical ability. Led the songs of praises in eternity, becomes lifted up in pride in those passages in Isaiah and Ezekiel. Says, I'll ascend and be like God. And God kicked him out with a third of those that went with him. I like the way God does things. He didn't try to talk the third out. Now that you see he's losing, you want another chance, he just threw him out. And he threw Adam and Eve out. And now, Paul is declaring the failure to see God, which is a faculty. I told you last Sunday the words Suni Amy, and I read from this wonderful book, this 10-volume series, Theological Dictionary of the New Testament, and I don't really want to have to repeat it as I try to race through today, that the word in the New Testament, you remember, describes a faculty. It is more than just head knowledge, more than an understanding that comes from much study and connecting the results of experiments. That's why the word senseless is used in the piece of paper that is the generally accepted translation. It is seen in the New Testament as a faculty, as a state of understanding, ability to see and perceive, that is a gift from God. And it is a gift to be cultivated. In some passages it says you're to pray for it. And it is augmented in the spirit life with the gifts of knowledge and discernment. These are not developed natural traits. It is a gift from God to all mankind initially that is being withdrawn, that makes them, to use a Greek carryover, makes them sense, without sense, senseless, because the capacity is withdrawn. I don't want to have to go through the reading in that dictionary again today, but in the Septuagint version, as I've often shown you, we learn in the full stream of the Old and New Testament, we learn the consistent in the revelatory stream meaning of a word. And this word, senseless, or sense, siame, is always used to translate been in the Hebrew. So we trace the stream of this concept of understanding back into the Old Testament roots, because they use the word here that Paul is using to translate in the Septuagint, the word been in the Old Testament. So I pulled out the theological word book of the Old Testament, a multi-volume again. I see what it says. As I laid this foundation, hoping to create a little fear of being casual about God. Here we are. Then. The verb used 247 times, main English usage is understanding or insight. The background idea of the verb is discern. And this lies behind the derivative noun because it is at its root meaning between. Be able to discern between. Make the right choice. Includes the concept of distinguishment that leads to understanding. It refers to knowledge which is superior to the mere gathering of data. It is necessary to give full understanding. A person can perceive or receive pertinent data with his senses. With his eyes he can discern, with his ears understand. But there is a level beyond that simple intellectual understanding, which is, I don't want to read all of this, which just illustrates it by verse after verse in the Old Testament. It is understanding that is a gift from God, Daniel 2, not the fruit of empiricism, scientism. It is ethical discernment. A person prays for it in Psalm 119. This insight's uniquely God's. He can reveal it or conceal it, Isaiah 29. The seed of insight is the heart, and it is the heart which discerns, or fails to discern, the works of the Lord, Psalm 28. The fear of the Lord, Proverbs 2. Righteousness and justice, Proverbs 2. And His will as His word is obeyed, Psalm 111. The possession of it required persistent diligence. It's more than IQ. It connotes character. And when one acts on the objective presentation of God's revelation, he will attain the ideal of significance of understanding, a gift from God. Now, I want you to understand, as I often say, I'm worried that you do not properly equate the fear of the Lord, the interest that you have in the things of God, the capacity to even want to know more about God, that you do not equate that, because of the cheap grace that's being peddled in the church world today, with the wonderful gift it is from God. Not everybody has the capacity. You can't just decide, well, I'm going to give God a try. No man, I repeat what I said earlier, from Jesus comes to the Father, save the Spirit drawing. This capacity can be withdrawn. Not only no one can come without the gift, it can be withdrawn. And I want to illustrate from science as we move back into this tunnel that grips the modern world, and I don't need to review it much. Mr. Smith, Dr. Smith, in the book that's now sold out in all the different bookstores, Religion Matters, borrowed from another author and described the current society as in a tunnel. In a tunnel, tragically, that is dated as I read from Hawking, we are victims of mediocre and twisted and dated scientism. And Hubert Smith, where is that book? Here somewhere. Houston Smith, Why Religion Matters, points out that what grips the modern world is not respect for science, scientism. This is review. And scientism, it's those little words on the end, ism, that make the difference. Scientism, because of the wonderful results of science that we see on every side, have deified it and made it everything, until the oppressive attitude of today's world, which I am trying to make sure your kids, when they get in college, will not just be easy targets for brainwashing. I want to warn some of you, as I showed you the fallacies of Darwinism last Sunday, I want to warn some of you, I'm talking to the teenagers, don't argue with your teachers. You learn here to respect authority. Just understand they're not God. And that they are as much a brainwashed product of higher education that has been the left wall of this tunnel and the law and the media that supports scientism as anyone else. And most of them are just passing on. Considering what we pay teachers, it's a miracle they're as good as they are. I've been saying for years we pay teachers what we pay these bonehead athletes. We'd change this nation overnight. I mean, I'm so sick of hearing Shaq and Kobe's arguments and the stupid media that makes so much out of it, I want to throw basketballs at the screen till it breaks. I mean, I'd tell that little 22-year-old straighten out and get his butt on the bench or upgrade him to Siberia. But you know, the players rule today. And the paper's really mad because they can't write about a fight because Jackson is just sitting there doing nothing and letting them fight it out. Man, that is really ruining the days of the newspaper people because they want a fight to talk about. And Bush is so dull, they can't keep off of Clinton. I mean, folks, we're in a tunnel. It just rains in on every side, presses in. And I've only started elaborating on Houston Smith's thesis, the foundation of the tunnel, scientism. And higher education has bought it lock, stock, and barrel. The law supports it in every occasion they have. The media closes the gap. And here we wander through life believing that science is wonderful. I'm going to demonstrate that in a minute. Scientism says science, if it's not the only way to truth, it's the best way. And that the only object of truth is the material universe. As I quoted, get rid of one of these books, Carl Sagan, Cosmos. All there is, that's all there is, and that's all that ever will be, is the cosmos. That's scientism. Its successes have turned it into a drunk. And it thinks that the only place to look for anything is in the light of material universe and scientific experiment. I'll try this again. You were pretty slow the last time. Therefore, all truth must be sought in that light alone. So the drunk's crawling around the lamppost. What are you doing? I'm looking for my keys. Well, did you lose them there? Well, no, I lost them over there by on the other side of the street, but that's the only place I can see to find them. You know, I lost them over there. Does that help it? Well, I can't see over there. I can always see here. Is that better? Scientism has deified the scientific method to the exclusion of everything else in an overreaction to the medieval church that would not allow anything outside of its barriers. Now, science earned its respect. I could race through the history and bore you with names, but back in the Greek days, they thought the Earth was inside a dome. The universe was inside a dome. And there were holes in the roof that you saw firelight through, and as the stars. Eventually, Rosthenes set sticks up. And he had put them close together, and notice that when the sun was given a perfect light shadow on one, the other one was a little off, and he separated the sticks by distance and concluded by drawing lines and angles where the center of the earth was, and the earth had to be circular from sticks in the ground. And they'd look at sailing ships and see the sails before they saw the boat. So it must be circular. And Aristotle felt the circle was the most perfect expression of anything, and therefore you had a latent theological idea behind it. The church bought into it, and I want you to remember, Ptolemy never developed his circular universe with the earth at the center, a series of circles for the planets, which he then explained certain variations by having some of these go in little circles of their own in their orbit, circles within a circle, Elijah's wheels. Remember, Ptolemy, 2nd century. The Apostle Paul is writing about 58 A.D. Ptolemy hadn't even refined the object of the universe. So in the revelation that Paul is giving, without the knowledge that I'm going to reel through in 70-league boots in a minute, I wish I could leap us through in quantum leaps, Paul is still declaring as God's oracle, with no more knowledge than pre-Ptolemaic, to not see God's hand in the universe and fail to worship Him and give Him glory and thanksgiving is to get the curse of sense withdrawn, namely the capacity to even find God. How much more? I mean, that simple universe never declared. It's amazing to me that Psalm 19 can hurl out, the heavens declare thy handiwork. They knew nothing of the nature of that handiwork that science has given us. Science, of all endeavors, should have enhanced the capacity to glorify God and give Him worship and thanks. From Ptolemy to Copernicus, who was largely ignored, picked up by Kepler and Galileo. The earth-centered view and the divinity of circles was broken. The sun is the center. Galileo, often called the father of modern science, 300 years from his death. Hawking is born, makes a big deal of that. With a telescope, they saw moons going around Jupiter. And science moves on to a much more complicated view as the various things developed, and you can jump back and forth, not necessarily on dates, the periodic tables in chemistry. Falteringly developed by that Russian Mendeleev, who just got cards and put them on a table and from an experience began to understand that when he did something chemically to an element, a piece of metal or something, then the combination that resulted from what he did was not the same. And he developed what we all learned without much thought in initial chemistry classes, that starting with hydrogen, each element of these chemical atoms are in a sequence so perfect that as he developed his table, undiscovered chemical atoms, he left gaps for them. Because as the research went on, it was discovered each time heat or whatever changes the nature, and energy applied changes the nature of one of those chemical elements from hydrogen, a particle is added each time to the nucleus that makes it a little different as you move on up. Then they come, having discovered these chemical elements, to radiation. Accidentally discovered, wrapping a piece of uranium crystal, thinking that maybe the light of the sun would cause something to happen to it. But it's a cloudy day, so he puts it in a drawer where there's no sunlight and comes back, discovers to his amazement that the crystal on top of the photographic plate, but wrapped and separated from it, what he thought was impenetrable stuff for this crystal or anything to happen, it burned an image. They go on to discover nuclear and atomic fission and breaking things apart because they're certain that these chemical elements so unstable that they're losing parts of the nucleus just randomly, and you disturb them very much and you get the hydrogen bomb. I mean, we have learned how this universe operates in the small and in the large, and I've been boring you with it for the last several days. They moved on from the chemical units to finding that the very makeup of these units in the periodic table gave off a light spectrum differential, that they actually could figure out what the chemical makeup was by the prism of light that is reflected off of them. This became the key for discovering, to everybody's amazement, that there is no element found in the universe that is not on Earth. Because they can analyze the light, and they figured out delicate instruments to separate the spectrum and the Fraunhofer lines, and they not only can tell what the star is made of by the light that's coming from it, they can tell its speed by the moving to the red side or the blue side of the spectrum that's coming toward us and crunching the light waves. If it's on the blue side, is going away from us and stretching the light wave on the red side. And we can predict speed of 600 million miles out there. And what do they find? I mean, Hubble's telescope is the one that found out that everything is expanding, going, and strangely enough, the furthest away galaxy is going faster than the close galaxies. And they can measure it with precision. Amazing. But at the furthest reaches of the universe, those out on the edge of what we see are going away from us, and this will be the third time I'll use the illustration. And it's the same wherever you are in the universe. Like a clump of raisins in a bowl of dough, and you heat it and the dough swells and expands. than every raisin, it looks like all the other raisins are going away from him. And out at the edge, going faster. Why is that? Well, they propose from the Big Bang Theory that the initial burst shot them out faster than that which follows. And so the outer edges are still going at a speed faster than the galaxies closer to us in this vast supposed explosion. And yet, though the outer edge is going faster than the closer ones, the whole business is slowing down a little. To keep the ratio of the outer part faster and the lower ones, closer ones, slower, but they're all going slower than they once were. So the expansion, theoretically, is slowing down. So modern scientists then began to figure out, since we now know the speed and the directions, like a videotape, we can reverse it. We can calculate where it would be going back. I mean, those that we see out there that are going the fastest, billions of miles away from us. Billions of miles. And we can tell how fast they're going and the direction they're going relative to a starting point. So let's reverse the procedure. And this was Hubble's idea first, and it comes back. He calculated 2 billion. Now it's somewhere between 12 and 20 billion they calculate. You go back eventually to where it all started. And you come to a mass using Einstein's formula where mass multiplied by the speed of light equals energy, and it never changed. Now that didn't come about overnight. Parity, working with magnets and electricity. And he was not an anti-God or anti-religion man. I got a book here that lists some of the leading scientists through history, that their faith helped them in their science progress. Faraday was one. He was a Sandemanian, a religious cult, who placed great emphasis on the sacredness of the circle. And it was that religious idea that made him postulate that from a magnet there was this twirling circle that would affect, like stuff that goes into the outlet of a sink as it washes around, you have some stuff in it, or cream on a cup. And from his experiments, trying to prove the sacredness of the circle, he came up with the law of conservation of energy that ruled during the Victorian age. That energy was never lost, it just exchanged for a different kind. I mean, that's muscle energy. When I did that, energy is released. Electric energy, magnetic energy, all kinds of energy change. Energy is not lost, it just changes its nature. Different type of energy. Then along comes Lavoisier, tax collector before the French Revolution, his head cut off with the guillotine because they made the money for research extorting surplus taxes. There's some real colorful stories, too, when you study science. Science can be, you know, the news media doesn't tell these stories. Let a preacher get involved like Einstein, you're going to get 14 months of headlines. I mean, he was already in bed with Elsa before he left his first wife. And she collapsed mentally and physically when he announced the divorce. He's already living with Elsa. I'm not his judge. God's his judge. We don't believe in God who judges. Occasionally he would casually refer to the old one. And when confronted, he said, I believe in Spinoza's God, which is the universe itself is God. And Spinoza's universe itself, pantheism, was panpsychism, that the universe mentally thinks. I mean, there's some fancy stories. Another one of the scientists irritates some rich guy, and the rich guy drives up in his buggy and has his goon get out and beat the shillelagh out of him until he has to flee the country. I mean, there's a lot of color in this. But because they're worshipped as gods, they're as bad as the Middle Ages. Oh, you're a science. You can be a moral reprobate. And they will call you as a scientist to come in there and comment on Jimmy Baker's failure. It was some genetic aberration. Am I boring you? The point is, I'm already ahead of time up to the media, which is the ceiling. The media makes people look good that they want to look good. Oh, you remember the newscaster not too many years ago here in Los Angeles that was caught and arrested for kiting about $400,000 worth of checks? You didn't see much of that talked about. That was one of their own. Oh, I happen to know, because my friend that is on KIEV still, how's old George doing? You still listen to him? He sends me inside stuff on how the news media protects its own. I mean, one of the greatest womanizers in New York. And a married one. Sits pontificating every night during the television evangelist scandals. Now, they may say, well, you were a womanizer. You don't know beans about me. I was with a lot of beautiful women, but I was single. And I didn't try to hide it. I put it out front. I was honest with you. I said, I got about one trip left in me. I'm going to make sure it's a good one. But I have always said, I say this to the gays. My complaint with the gay community is not their choice of side of the street. It ain't mine. But my biggest complaint is their lack of fidelity. I believe a covenant made should be kept. And as I have said, I've always been a one-woman kind of man. I've proven that over the years. But I sure wasn't going to raid my congregation, which some preachers do. And I went out figuring I got one trip in me, and I found the best that I may live another 4 years. But I want you to know there's a difference between when I talk about a womanizer who's being unfaithful to his wife. I was single. And all these preachers criticizing me used to watch the girls I was with know how horrible. And they'd pray for the wife to leave the room so they could do private and obscene things to themselves while they watched. Can I hear an amen? Hypocrites. That's what I'm talking about, the media. Hypocrites. They anoint their own because this is a tunnel. They want to keep us captive. When they're captive, they're too dumb to know there's any peepholes out of the tunnel. Science has achieved amazing things. And it's pretty hard to refute the logic of the Big Bang. But what most people don't understand is what the Catholic, Le Mosier, saw, that this presupposed a primeval Adam from which everything came, which presupposes a beginning. And the other side of the coin is, since it's slowing down, the possibility of an end. Now, the scripture says, heaven and earth shall pass away, but my word will never pass away. So immediately, creationists that were smart enough to understand the Big Bang begin to see in it a chink in the science frame of reference that ruled God out. Who banged it? And who put it there in the first place? A bang. A bang presumes a banger. You got that? Oh, no. And I think when we talk of a Big Bang, most of you probably, not this audience, but the average audience, thinks of some mighty, vast globe of something blowing up, like Mount Vesuvius, or a giant takes a big volcano to wipe out a countryside. Now, all the mass is compressed to one point, densely packed down. And all of that mass, by whatever factor you multiply, the factor of massness, which is beyond comprehension, because all the mass in the universe compacted to one dot. To get within range of it would turn you into spaghetti. Down to one dot. And all that mass of the entire universe. By the way, another thing science has found out is that 90%, and some say 99%, is dark matter that we've never seen. They're still looking for. And there's a whole group of scientists called machos. It's an acronym. That are looking for this halo and some evidence of dark matter that can't be seen. They've isolated neutrinos in a nuclear reactor. There are small elements of something. They have zero radius. They don't know if they have mass. They're trying to figure out if they have mass. That actually go through, penetrate straight through. And experimental studies define these, since these will penetrate that which shields radiation from going out. They want to build something like a shield so far underneath the ground in some deep mine somewhere that neutrinos from the universe, which would give evidence of dark unseen matter that will penetrate right through the earth, get down there and hit this shield, and only those that they're looking for will have the capacity to go through the shield that blocks everything else out. These macho men have been looking for neutrinos. They've found a few. Now they have another hard thing to call wimps. They're looking for weak dark matter. I mean, they're pushing the realms of the universe everywhere. And when they get out there with all we've learned, they can only look at 90%. I mean, they're going to look at 10%, reverse. 90% is there, but they can't see it, and they don't know anything about it. And they're still searching, trying to find what's the nature of this dark matter. But if we go to the Big Bang and go back in all the dark matter, and the 10%, which is the whole universe that we now know, is compressed, all that mass in one place, the energy it contains is the total mass times the speed of light squared. Isn't that 670 million? In other words, that mass must be multiplied by 670 million. Don't do the work. Doesn't matter the principle. I mean, we know light's 186,000 miles a second. And six times that's 11 million something. And six times that, or whatever it is, 60 times that, which takes it to an hour, is 670 million. Speed of light, 670 million miles an hour. Or just take the speed of light per second. Right there in that second. Multiply 186,000 miles a second, or 670 million miles an hour, times the factor of mass. That's the energy that is released in one explosion from a dot. I've got a dot there on the blackboard. A dot that's the size of a proton, which is that little element inside the nuclei of a molecule. That's how big a proton that we haven't yet seen. We can only see the effects of its presence. That proton, have you really moved your mind there to that point? All the universe compressed to the size of a proton. That's what the Big Bang Theory presumes. And with that much energy, a banger set it off. And you can only get to within millimeters, even less than that, of seconds, to the moment of blast, because the heat is so great that the clouds, there's no way you'll ever see what was there. And from that blast, all the elements went out. Einstein wanted the world to be so ordered that his formula, his mathematical formula, could predict every movement. And as C.S. Lewis, who is somewhat dated, brilliant but dated, said years ago in Miracles, he called it naturalism. Houston Smith calls it scientism. Everything had to be explainable by cause and effect. Science can discover the meaning of everything, and the whole object of truth is the cosmos as it is. And the only way to discover truth is this route. And if there is something random, something that cannot be predicted, to which the rules cannot harness, then naturalism's basic premise is gone and scientism's basic premise is gone, because that opens the possibility there might be something, some truth and some source of truth and even some being outside this cosmos that could have had the power to bring it into existence and make it run. The banger. The great banger. I'm sure God and theology through the centuries has never quite defined God in that way. The ultimate banger. Fourth of July in eternity. Light the match, son. Don't have to. All I have to do is speak. Because I spoke. The bang unit out of nothing. That's what Hebrews 11:3 says. That's where faith begins. We believe that which is seen, which is the subject matter of science, that which is seen, was brought together, made, formed, came into being from nothing. Absolutely nothing. Now, the other side of the spectrum, quantum mechanics, and it's a dichotomy as bad as Faraday's law of conservation of energy. And Lavoisier's conservation of mass, where he learned that mass just changes place. And it took the addition of light and Einstein's formulas to figure out that energy and mass have a perfect balance, and mass is lost into energy, and energy is lost into mass, but somebody's keeping books, and it stays the same. Likewise, Einstein's formula allowed the magna universe, the large universe, to be predicted with unerring accuracy. But on the other side of the coin, from the early alchemists who were trying to change ordinary metals into gold, through the chemical, the periodic tables, through the studies, through microscopes and subatomic particles, and the ultimate discovery that an atom consists of a nuclei with particles going around it, and the ability to separate the particles, and then as they've continued to go deeper and deeper and deeper, it gets more complicated as they go down to the elements of light, which are clusters of photons, and then they reach an uncertainty principle where they can't really tell. You can't measure position and speed at the same time, and they don't know for sure whether light is a wave or a particle because it acts both ways, and sometimes you got a single particle or a single photon of light going to a split, and it somehow manages to be in both places at once. They've now come up with what's called the quantum leap, that there are certain electrons that can change place and cross the distance to the other side simultaneously with no connection between them. And the EPR experiments, Einstein and some Polish fellow and Rosen, Podolsky or something like that, they discovered that two particles that have contact, you can separate them after that, and if you spin one to the right, the other will spin to the left, even though they're instantly totally separated in space. Weird. I mean, this Einstein himself called spooky. You separate them. Spin this one. An exaggerated lay kind of term of spin, which is more complicated than that. The other one will spin the other way. Spin that one right, because it spins left. They've discovered even smaller pieces of particles as they keep probing into the micro-universe, trying to find the end, so they can, as Hawking says, when we understand it all, we'll have the mind of God. We're so close. And as I read last Sunday, one person says, yeah, they're so close that if they scratch a little more, they'll, right there's the face of God. But they absolutely refuse to include God in the equation. Einstein hated quantum mechanics. It stunted his development because quantum mechanics introduced an uncertainty that couldn't be predicted by his formula. And as they pushed that uncertainty down to the most microscopic elements, they find the same thing they find out in the macro. There's a border out there we don't know. There's a point out there we don't know what's happening. We don't know how it's going to end, but it has the terrorizing probability it will end long after we're dead. But this universe will end under the Big Bang Theory. And we'll start to collapse. And Hawking, so fighting against a beginning which requires a beginner and an ender, he has proposed imaginary time If you keep it like an hourglass just flipping over, except the arrow of time, to use this complicated phrase, points the other direction, so rational creatures can only live in the expanding period, not the collapsing period. And nobody can understand what he's talking about, this imaginary time. He says it'll become as important as Einstein's theory in future years to him. We'll go across the Atlantic, and when we're done, I'm sure Hawking understands his theory of imaginary time. As you push it down, you come to the unknown. And the point I am making is that these brilliant scientists absolutely refuse the leading voices to include God. I must keep digging. It's like a perversion to where Einstein once describes it as a religious experience, comparable only to religious worship and the feelings a lover has, a passion to know. But ruled out is God. And one of the funniest books on the subject, they finally get down to the substratum. And as C.S. Lewis says, these uncertainties in quantum mechanics, how, in essence, these packets of light work is where it started. This uncertainty down there, they found that from a vacuum, from nothing, mass or energy can be made to come forth. They're down to where they're reaching into the realm, and they think they found the bottom, but they thought they had the bottom with the atom. It goes from one end to the other, so vast, so incomprehensible, and yet we can't allow God to even be considered. And this Nobel Prize winner has written this clever book, really clever. And he uses an illustration for trying to show why that the scientists can justify their conclusions. I mean, Hawking tells a story of a woman when he was talking about black holes and the origin of the universe. She got up and says, "Bosh! What do you mean, bosh? The whole thing is on the back of turtles." Well, the oldest Hindu view of the universe had elephants holding up the universe, standing on the back of turtles, sitting on a snake that was in a circle. So she wasn't that far off. If you're an ancient Hindu. Am I boring you? This is heavy stuff. There's a point that I want to make. So he says, another woman came in and said to him, this guy, who's Leon Lederman, said, "Have you ever seen an atom?" And he said, "No, ma'am." That got him to thinking. "No, I haven't seen an atom. Nobody's ever seen an atom. But he described an event that tells you how the scientists draw these conclusions. Everything. The existence of dark matter. I mean, we used to think light shines straight. Now we know it goes in a, it's curved. Gravity bends it. Now we know that space is warped and has undulations like you throw a bunch of bowling balls on a waterbed. So light, now when it travels, you know why stars twinkle? It's amazing what they found out. You know why stars twinkle? Well, in revolving stars, there is an interference, let's say, with the light waves. And one light wave starts its journey and gets here, and Another one is affected by gravity and is bent that causes two of them to hit at the same time. One took a little circular route and the other one came in. And in this bending of rays and in some combination when this matter is passing by, you get a double blast sometimes and a single blast other times to oversimplify it. So they've been able to even predict dark matter influencing waves. And when we're looking out here at a star, and they proved it during an eclipse, the star is right behind the sun. And the light is coming, bent by the sun, around the sun to us. And we're seeing around the corner, but we think the star's out here when it's over there behind the sun. Because gravity has bent the light waves. These are incomprehensible things to the natural sensitivity of the way we look at things. But it's absolutely evidenced by this kind of procedure. I got enough time. He says, imagine an intelligent race of beings from the planet Twilo. They look more or less like us, they talk like us, and do everything like humans except for one thing. They have a fluke in their visual apparatus. They can't see objects with sharp juxtapositions of black and white. They can't see zebras, for example. It's just invisible because their visual apparatus has got this blind spot that if black and white are juxtapositioned together, it becomes nothing. So they can't see zebras. They can't see the shirts on NFL referees. They can't see soccer balls. Now, you need to know that there's two literal blind spots in the center of our field of vision, so this is not so strange. We drive 100 miles an hour extrapolating this little blind spot. But these have a total blind spot. They can't see black and white together. So let's say this contingent from the planet Twilo comes to Earth on a goodwill mission. To give them a taste of our culture, we take them to see one of the cultural events on the planet, World Cup soccer match. We, of course, don't know they can't see the black and white soccer ball. So they sit there watching the match with polite but confused looks on their faces. And as far as the Twiloans are concerned, a bunch of short-pantsed people are running up and down the field, kicking their legs pointlessly in the air and banging into each other and falling down. At times, an official blows a whistle, a player runs to the sideline, stands there, and extends both arms over his head while the other player is watching. Once in a great while, the goalie inexplicably falls to the ground. Great cheer goes up, and one points toward the opposite team. The Twiloans spend about 15 minutes being totally mystified. Then, to pass the time, they attempt to understand the game. Some use classification techniques. They deduce, partially because of the clothing, that there are two teams in conflict with one another. They chart the movements of the various players, discovering that each player appears to remain more or less within a certain geographical territory on the field. They discover that different players display different physical motions. The Twiloans, as humans would do, clarify their search for meaning in the World Cup soccer by giving names to the different positions played by each footballer. The positions are categorized, compared, and contrasted. The qualities and limitations of each position are listed on a giant chart. And a major breakthrough comes when the Twiloans discover that symmetry is at work. For each position on Team A, there's a counterpart position on Team B. With two minutes remaining in the game, the Twiloans have composed dozens of charts, hundreds of tables and formulas, scores of complicated rules about soccer matches. And though the rules might be in a limited way correct, none would really capture the essence of the game. Then one young pipsqueak of a Twiloan, silent until now, speaks his mind. "Let's postulate," he ventures nervously, "the existence of an invisible ball." "Say what?" replied the elder Twiloans. While his elders were monitoring what appeared to be the core of the game, the comings and goings of the various players and the demarcation of the field, the pipsqueak was keeping his eyes peeled for rare events, and he found one. Immediately before the referee announced the score, and a split second before the crowd cheered wildly, the young Twiloan noticed the momentary appearance of a bulge in the back of the goal net. Soccer is a low-scoring game, so there were few bulges to observe, and each was very short-lived. Even so, there were enough events for the pipsqueak to note that the shape of each bulge was hemispherical. Hence his wild conclusion that the game of soccer is dependent upon the existence of an invisible ball. invisible at least to the Twilons. The rest of the contingent from Philo listen to this theory, and weak as the empirical evidence is, after much arguing, they conclude that the youngster has a point. That's the way science looks at reality beyond our sensibility, out and in. We are limited with our sensory apparatus. If when we saw electrons, and a bear was coming at us, it would look like mostly space, and we'd be eaten before we figure out a bear's there. Our sensory apparatus is tuned to the world we live in. But the hunger for knowledge, which is justified, which God says ought to create an appreciation of His vastness, instead produced an elimination in the minds of scientism of God from His creation, which He created for us, and He's fed up. As the bulge in the net indicated, there is a ball out there. As you go to the far edge of space, without a God, it's going to wind down, and with a God, it's going to wind down by declaration. Because God Himself said it will come to an end. He'll create a new heaven and a new earth. And we that have faith are asked to believe that from nothing God spoke all this. Now they pushed to the God particle. That's what I was just reading from, that book. What did I do with it? The book I just read from. Huh? Yes, on the podium. The God particle. I choose to call it, just with my, that side of me that always does this, I call it Higgs' bosom. The bosom of God. Out of His bosom. Now I can't find my glasses. Huh? Huh? I'm running out of time. I've heard of a land. He's written a full book on Higgs boson. They don't know whether it's a particle or not. They don't know whether it's a soup, a plasma. But they've suddenly discovered, and they're building a 50-some mile particle accelerator in Texas. And you had it in the news that CERN, the one's about to be dismantled for a bigger one to be built in Europe, that runs some 20-some miles. And they've proven so many things with this accelerator. For example, gravity slows time down. Speed slows time down. So in that time phase, you ought to get younger or age more slowly. And they've proven with absolute predictability the particle age of certain particles. And they blast them up to near the speed of light, 99% of it, and find that this particle that had an exact decay life lived 400 years, 400 times more, 400 times as much, proving absolutely that slowdown of time, of course, you'd be as big as the universe, because mass increases with the speed. But they now found at that remote beginning of the universe, what they're calling, or this man's calling, the God particle. He says, why the God particle? Two reasons. One, the publisher wouldn't let us call it the goddamn particle. Though that might be a more appropriate title, given its villainous nature and the expense it is causing. And two, there is a connection of sorts to another book, a much older one. Now, I want to take up with this God particle next Sunday as I finish the legacy of scientism, but the point I make has been made throughout the message. The reason I'm doing this is made throughout the message. Why? If Paul is condemning them when they didn't even have Ptolemy's view of the universe, if God through Paul is saying, I've had it, your stubborn unwillingness to give me credit for what I have made and provided for you, how much more when science has unveiled the glories of this creation beyond even the wildest dreams of the Apostle Paul. And those that have been gifted by God with gifts from Him to mine its depths and look to its furthest reaches and still stubbornly rule God out. Why? 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 As a young boy, Stephen Hawking says, I was the despair of my parents because I was always taking things apart to see what made them tick. Of course, I generally couldn't get them back together again, but I felt that if I understood how something worked, then in a sense, I was the master of it. R.C. Sproul has pointed out, atheism is a psychological state. We don't want to accept God's sovereignty. We don't want to have a master. We want to be the master. We don't want to bow before God and give Him glory. We want the Nobel Prize to not be shared by anyone. At least the athletes, some of them that I decried earlier, on occasions can be found to give God glory for their talents. What Paul is saying, in a limited understanding world, God fed up your failure to recognize my hand in the handiwork, I will take away the ability and turn you into a senseless one who no longer will have the capacity to see me if I'm standing face to face with you. I will take it away. That's what stubborn turning from the knowledge can do for you. God, in the God particle, Higgs boson, the bosom of God as I call it, from which everything goes, spawns a book, and what a title. What a title. I gotta find this and just give you the title. I gotta find it. It's here somewhere. There it is. The Hole in the Universe. How scientists fit over the edge of emptiness and found everything, and what is everything? This whole book's about it. Where the science have brought us today. Nothing? Where is it? What have they found? Nothing. Nothing is too wonderful to be true. What they're saying. Nothing's too wonderful to be true. Nothing. Nothing blows up. The classic Big Bang Theory described the aftermath of the bang, but makes no attempt to describe what banged, how it banged, or what caused it to bang. Nothing. Nothing perfect. Zero means don't change. Don't move. Zero is the one that doesn't make a difference. That's an honest to God zero. Nothing. Not anything at all. That's what faith starts with. That's what God's Word asks you to believe. that this wonderful thing, explore it. Explore it, explore it, explore it. But expand as you expand the circumference of knowledge. Expand the appreciation of what I have wrought. As your habitat, your place, your surroundings. Don't rule me out, because you ain't ever going to catch me. God's particle, Higgs bosom, that's where I will be next Sunday. And we will go into that other book. But I have failed if you have missed the point. I don't think you have. The same pursuit. The same subject matter can make you give God glory, worship Him, and thank Him for His greatness. Or it can cause you to refuse to consider Him in the equation when all of these various formulas that ruled Him out are now down to nothing. Which the Word says He created it all from. And if you continue to persist in a stubborn unwillingness to recognize the Sovereign One and His power, okay, He will take from you the capacity to ever see Him until you become the blind leading the blind, closing a tunnel about you and making your view the only view, and God's left out. But I got news for you. He shoved you out. That's the consequence, and that's my message today. I'll take you to that other book tomorrow, next Sunday. From this pulpit, but Jay Leno announced the fact that three Nobel Prize winners a few years ago had won the Nobel Prize for discovering the smallest thing in the universe, which he said was a steak at Denny's. Now, that's humorous. Denny's is not going to like me for that. In fact, I don't ever remember eating a steak at Denny's, so I don't really know. But God, that tells you how scientism controls the brain. This is all unrevelatory of God at all. It calls for no worship, no glorification of God. No sense of awe. No humility and state of wonder. And what ridiculousness that a random blast of something as small as a proton could produce all this perfectionism. I've said it already. For an enzyme to evolve is the equivalent of a tornado hitting a junkyard and a 747 with six pilots in the cabin fly out of that tornado. It cannot happen without purpose and without control. And yet, as wonderful as this creation is, God, who spoke it into existence, says it'll pass away. But His Word is forever. That Word, faith in which is based upon accepting the fact that from nothing God made it, is what this church exists to proclaim. That Word is what we will hang our bodies on next Sunday night as we claim the miracle of healing for those that are sick among us. With His stripes, you were healed. I want you to understand that the God that we will meet around the communion table is the one who spoke these worlds into existence, who died for us, who cares for us. I really believe some of you are still so in the grip of scientism, you don't believe a miracle's going to happen. You get news that cripples are walking and blind are seeing, there won't be enough space and enough room for parking within a mile of the place. You have to not believe. Then when you see, you'll believe. The Christian believes to see and sees in this universe the mastery of a hand that cares for us and a mastery of a hand who arranged the molecules that make us up and breathed into us and gave us life and will put His Spirit in us and can interfere with this world to take care of His own. That's what this church stands for. I hope you'll be making your reservations for